Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Auto Central, South Africa's number one motoring podcast, and Auto Trader's number one channel for you to see our their ugly faces, Wandy.
I think mine's not so ugly. In my personal opinion, but you know, you be the judge.
Well, if you want to watch us, you can watch us. If you want to listen to us, you can listen to us too. And as usual, my name is George Meany, and I'm joined by Wandile Sishi, as usual. Where can people find what we're doing here?
So as you mentioned, you can definitely find us on the Auto Trader YouTube channel,
which is Auto Trader SA,
correct? But if you want to listen to us, we're also streaming live every single Monday at 9 a.m. on cliffcentral.com. But if you want some convenience, you can also just find us on Spotify or iTunes to your convenience. But that'll also just be the audio.
Google Auto Central or just go onto Auto Trader's YouTube channel.
Pretty much.
Should be everywhere.
Yeah, if you just search.
So in today's Auto Central episode, Wandy and I are joined by none other than Les McMaster, who is the director of Right to Repair. And Les is here to unpack the latest proposed government guidelines, or should I say Competition Commission guidelines, that state to aim to promote more competition in South Africa's automotive aftermarket environment, including manufacturing, repairs, insurance, and financing. And these proposed guidelines are meant to bring more transparency into the prices and practices and give consumers more choice. And it's a bit progressive in relation to South Africa, but not so progressive in relation to the rest of the world, as you'll probably hear from Les. And it is regulatory. So in the rest of the world, this has become the norm. So welcome, Les. Glad to have you.
Thank you, George. You, awesome to be here.
Yeah. Second time you're on with us, yeah?
Second time.
Second time. The last time was in the Cliff Central Studios, if correct. I recall. Correct. And Les has not aged a day.
No.
Thank you, George.
I think people are going to watch the YouTube just to see Les and his young sprightliness. I've known Les for quite a few years. How many years has it been now? 11 years. Yeah, I've known Les for 11 years, and I honestly can say he hasn't changed a bit. He's still
neither of you, George.
Thanks, I appreciate that. Wandy's the youngster amongst us.
I'm the young one, but I've also known Les for like a year now.
True.
You know, it's growing. We're gonna get real close.
You never know.
You never know. Well, anyway, thanks for joining us, Les. Appreciate it extremely. And I don't think there's too many people, if anybody, that could kind of give us the detail of where the rubber hits the road when it comes to this topic, because you've been one of the leaders of this Right to Repair since day one. Give us a short version of the history. How did you end up doing this? Why did you do it? And where did we find ourselves just before this Competition Commission guideline output?
Well, George, in 2009, and prior to that, workshop owners were at loggerheads with the OEs because OEs had started to code more parts into their vehicles, and that coding had to be done online. And, of course, the more parts that were being coded, the more aftermarket workshops were being excluded. So we found that after 5, 6, 7 years, that the vehicle had been on the road and had maybe had the third or the fourth owner, a part would be faulty. That could only be bought from the dealer, which is fine, but that part can be purchased by an aftermarket dealer because it was a security-related part. And, of course, then once the owner had bought the part and he brought it to an aftermarket workshop, the aftermarket workshop couldn't do anything with it. I mean, they could fit the part, but then it had to go back to a dealer to be coded into the VIN of the vehicle, and we saw this happening more and more. And I realized that if we didn't start what already had started in Europe, in South Africa, the Right to Repair, we would be excluded and be downgraded to doing only certain mechanical work in aftermarket workshops,
which I suppose goes away in the future of electric vehicles as well.
Yeah. So absolutely. But what we were seeing in our workshops was that the third and the fourth owner, firstly, couldn't afford to buy that part. And because he couldn't buy it, there were very clever people that were bypassing these parts.
Oh,
and
wow.
If you think of braking system, when ABS braking system was bypassed. You know, it becomes a normal braking system. But then you must remember that vehicle was never designed to have just a normal braking system. It was designed around the ABS braking system. And we would have these cars on the road, and when they came to the workshop, you would, you know, you'd be horrified to see what people have done, because firstly, they couldn't afford to buy the part, and secondly, they needed wheels.
Okay.
Yeah, what are they going
to
do?
And this started to escalate, and we realized that if we didn't start the right repair in South Africa, we would be left with a lot of vehicles on the road, very dangerous vehicles on the road. And a lot of workshops that would be out of business.
So let's unpack the first point, you know, in the Competition Commission's guidelines. But before we get there, let me just ask you this question. The Competition Commission kind of set out a list of guidelines. Now, guidelines is not regulation. It's not promulgated. It's guidelines set out by the Competitions Commission. Maybe just explain to everybody the difference between the guidelines the Competitions Commission put out and the concept called regulation, because I've heard them being used interchangeably, and I keep reminding people that this is not regulation. But you know, not to put words in your mouth, you know, you said to me the other day, these are guidelines with teeth.
Correct.
So how does that work?
So the Competition Commissioner, when we initially approached the Competition Commissioner with the with our concerns. You know, they had a look at it and they said, look, you know, we can see this is like totally uncompetitive. You're excluding a large portion of the motor industry only purely because the OEs had made these rules and were building these parts into the vehicle. And they started off, our first prize would have been that it became legislation.
Yeah.
Which would have been, you know, then it would have been cast in stone.
Yes.
But the Competitions Commissioner said, no, we do it. We'll go through the thing, we'll have the consultation, and then we'll draw up the guidelines. And the guidelines will be there and will be used when we do an arbitration in the case of there being any complaint that was laid with the Competitions Commission. They would do it in the light of the guidelines will now be used to see where the uncompetitive behavior is.
Okay.
Is that until it becomes regulation, or is it just entirely?
So practically, if you felt that you'd been compromised, you'd lay a complaint with the Competition Commissioner. The guidelines are now being discussed and have been accepted by everybody.
Yeah.
And if it said that I was excluded from buying a part from a dealer, the Competition Commissioner would look at it in the anti-competitive manner that they rule, and they will say, "Yeah, we in favor of the complainant." And then it becomes they have to do it.
Okay. So
there's the teeth.
Teeth. So you know, for all intents and purposes, it you know, it is up to the OEM whether they want to accept the guidelines and put them in place or not, and then it's up to the consumer to kind of chase any anti-competitive behavior in their opinion if they were excluded, is what you're saying.
Given that they know, though, I think that's one of the big challenges, is that a lot of people don't actually know what their rights are or what the guidelines actually state.
Yeah.
They just see it as regulation or a guideline, and they kind of
A lot of people are thinking that it's regulation when it's guidelines.
It's just guidelines, and
there's a different procedure involved.
There's a procedure.
Yes, yeah. There's a procedure.
Procedure there has to be followed. And we've had some test cases where, without mentioning any models and makes and OEs, where an aftermarket workshop had a vehicle in their workshop. They needed to purchase a tool to be able to do a certain work on that vehicle, and the dealer said, "Sorry, we can't sell it to you. It's not allowed to." They put a complaint to the Competitions Commissioner, and within a couple of days, the dealer said, "Sorry, we made a mistake. Yes, you can buy the tool."
Oh, okay.
So that's happened already.
Yeah, and I mean, it could have been I suppose in this particular incident, it could have been a legitimate. We can't sell you the tool because I don't think everybody's 100% clear yet. You know, I've been asked a couple of questions where, you know, I've had to ring up Les and say, you know, I've been asked this question, you know, what is the process? Because I don't think those guidelines and the route to the recourse is really that clear.
Yes, it is actually. If you think of the negative of it was that the Competitions Commissioner didn't really state the procedure of how a claim should be made or a complaint should be laid. But we as Right2Pay South Africa have drawn up a document where we will assist the aftermarket workshops and the public on how to lay the complaint.
Okay.
And who it must go to. It's actually pretty simple, really, but, you know, it's more, if somebody has a document in front of you and, you know, step by step, this is what you must do, it's a lot easier.
Yes.
And we as Right2Pay South Africa do not lay the complaint on behalf of anybody.
Okay.
We will assist the complainant.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into the actual detail, and that is kind of one of the concepts in the Competitions Commission's guideline is price bundling. And when I'll go through very quickly. When a consumer buys a vehicle, they're typically sold a maintenance plan and a service plan included in the purchase price of the vehicle. Most consumers are unaware that the purchase price of the vehicle is bundled with these value-added products. The commission said that this bundling may make the purchasing of these plans easier. For some customers who would otherwise have sought them out separately. However, some customers can and do purchase these value-added products outside of the standard manufacturer's provided plan from third-party suppliers. So, you know, give us the layman's version of the price unbundling, Les.
So when you purchase your vehicle, the perception is that I'm purchasing a vehicle with a full maintenance plan. So fantastic. You know, I'm paying. This is going to be my one payment, and I can have my vehicle serviced. But when we were doing the preparation of the Right2Pay, we were in Europe, and we were garnering a lot of expertise from how they had done it. They were absolutely astonished that in South Africa, a vehicle is sold with a maintenance contract. It just doesn't happen. And we started doing our homework, and we realized that, you know, it's actually an expensive process. Because some vehicles, depending on the model and the make, we're adding 70 to 80,000 rand onto the price of the vehicle.
Wow.
And if you looked and really started to break it down, you're probably going to get 2 to 3 services.
Yeah.
And you take 3 services and divide by the 70 to 80,000 rand, and you realize what you're actually paying for a service. Apart from that, that's added into the HP of the vehicle hire purchase, which you're paying an interest rate on. So you on the 80,000 rand, 70,000 rand, there's hire purchase charges added onto that.
Yes.
So it's not a cheap exercise. But, of course, you know, people will always want that, which is good. But they also now have the option of when they purchase the vehicle that they don't have to have an included service plan.
Yeah.
It has to be open and transparent at the point of sale. So you buy your vehicle, it would be a price, and then do you want the service plan? This is the service plan. This is the price added on.
Okay.
So you make the decision. And if you decide that you want the service plan, you sign the contract with that OE and the dealership, and then they will be doing the services.
And more importantly, you can actually decide who you want to do that process with.
So if you decide that you didn't want the service plan, then you can take that vehicle to an aftermarket dealer of your choice.
Yes.
And those do the services for which you will pay, but obviously we know it's going to be a lot cheaper.
It'll be 70,000 rand.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot cheaper.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure that a lot of consumers are going to remain in that environment, and it can't be the case that these products from OEMs don't add value. They have to add value, otherwise, I suppose it remains to be seen over time. It could create an environment where the OEs can actually get more business by being more transparent.
Yeah.
Because I think you and I spoke about this before. It's not necessarily binary. It doesn't mean just because Right2Repair is in place now, there's going to be a mass exodus out of these maintenance plans. It just doesn't happen, But I suppose, one of the questions in my mind is, and a lot of people maybe misunderstand this, and that is the difference between the maintenance plan and the warranty. And so that's the unbundling of the maintenance plan and the servicing of the vehicle. Let's talk a little bit about the warranty of the vehicle, because that warranty is attached to the vehicle, if I'm right.
Yeah. Correct.
And every time a car rolls off the manufacturer's floor, it comes with a particular warranty. Now, what does this set of guidelines do to that warranty, and how is it impacted? How is that warranty impacted by these guidelines?
So the uncompetitive behavior when it came to warranties was one of our concerns. And the competition commissioner looked at it and he said, yeah, look, you know, this is not the way it should be. We saw manufacturers that were extending warranties. You'd have a warranty for 3, 5, 10 years warranty, but the proviso was that you would have to service it with them. And they could charge you what they want to. If you didn't have a maintenance plan or a service plan, you still had to take the vehicle to them to have it serviced. So when the competition commissioner had a look at the how it was being operated, you know, they saw the case of it being an uncompetitive system. And so they decided, as in Europe, where if you have a vehicle under warranty, and it's a 3-year warranty, you can service your vehicle with an aftermarket workshop. And it won't affect the warranty, but the warranty repair will still be done with the dealer network.
Okay, so there's a network. That's the distinct difference, is that you can't take your vehicle to an independent workshop and have a warranty part repaired.
No.
Yeah, you know, so you know, maybe that is part of some of the ambiguity that when I read these guidelines, it wasn't entirely clear that you know, if your gearbox breaks or if your brake calipers fail, that's actually a warranty repair.
Correct.
and the OEM still has to repair it for the vehicle to maintain its warranty. So you know, how do consumers navigate the warranty when it comes to having a car serviced outside of the OE network, so let's say by an independent servicer, and then something major breaks, that's a warranty claim. But now they've been having the car serviced outside of the OEM.
So previously, when there was a warranty issue, the first thing that the dealer network would do, they would take the service book and have a look at the service book and see if the services had been kept up to date. Mm-hmm. Previously, if you had missed the service, your warranty
was expired.
Well, expired.
Yes.
That was void.
Yeah.
So,
which I suppose, you know, in principle is fine. It's fair. You've got to have your car serviced in order to keep it running.
Correct.
Yeah.
So what would happen now if there's a mechanical breakdown or some faulty part? They will still see it was serviced. Yes, it was serviced by whom? Aftermarket workshop. Okay. Was the procedure done correctly? Yes, the procedure was done correctly, because the guidelines stipulate that when a service is done at an aftermarket workshop, it has to be meticulously recorded.
Okay.
So that you know what oils were fitted, you know what parts were fitted, and you can fit aftermarket parts, by the way.
Okay.
So all that will be recorded. But then they have a look at the breakdown. Was the breakdown directly attributed to the service in any way or form?
Okay.
If it wasn't, it's just normal warranty. But let's say, for instance, the repairer or the servicing dealer, aftermarket servicing dealer, had put in a cheap filter, and that filter broke up and disintegrated and went into the oil channel and caused engine failure. Then the OEE would say, you serviced it there. This is what happened. We have all the details of what happened.
Yeah.
Now that servicing dealer is responsible for the repair.
Okay.
And that's why we said, when aftermarket service providers do service vehicles under warranty, they must adhere strictly to the service schedule. And we've made provision for that. They have at their disposal the absolute every single major manufacturer service schedule. So there's no reason for them not to be doing that.
Yes.
So that's kind of the guarantee for the OEM, is that procedure that needs to be followed in terms of how the service is undertaken. That's how they can ensure that they're not being essentially robbed or...
Exactly.
Or there's liability for the dealership or the repair store, essentially.
Correct.
Okay.
So I suppose what you're saying is there's some onus and recourse on the service sensor. So this isn't a case of just, you know, anybody and their cat can open up an aftermarket service center and begin, you know, servicing cars. There are rules to follow.
Correct.
You know, it's not like, you know, anybody on the street corner can begin servicing cars.
Exactly.
That's not what, you're proposing. It's a case of, you know, we want to uphold the warranty and the lifespan of the car by doing things properly. Okay, then the other concept that I suppose is worth noting in these guidelines is the transfer of maintenance and service plans. So previously, was this the case or wasn't it the case? But manufacturers and other providers must transfer the maintenance plan. Now, we're not talking about the warranty now because the warranty is attached to the car. The maintenance plan and or a service plan to a replacement vehicle in the event where the original vehicle is written off by the insurer. Where there's no replacement vehicle after the write-off and is not feasible to transfer the maintenance plan or service plan to a replacement vehicle, the consumer shall be afforded the right to cancel the value-added contract and receive a full refund. Explain to us again in layman's terms, Les, what does that actually mean?
So from a new vehicle warranty, if the warranty came with the vehicle, so if you after 1 year sold your vehicle that had a 3-year warranty, the new owner will have the balance of that warranty because
you mean the maintenance plan?
No, the warranty.
The warranty. Okay. Okay.
So the maintenance plan is a contract between the OE.
Yes.
And the owner of the vehicle.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So what you're saying is so even if you sell the vehicle, the warranty continues for that vehicle, and the maintenance plan is slightly different.
Well, the Competition Commissioner tried to add in OEs, the mechanical breakdown insurances, and the crash insurers.
Yes.
Where they would, you bought a car and you had a mechanical breakdown insurance attached to it, for instance, a second-hand car, for instance.
Yeah. Okay, so when it comes to warranties and maintenance plans, and the transferability of those, you were saying that that they were... They're obviously included some with the vehicle, the warranty specifically, but the maintenance plan is a contract between?
The owner of the vehicle and the dealer.
Okay.
So in that case where that is, if he had sold the vehicle, he must be repaid the balance of the thing.
Okay. So they sold...
All that would be added onto his new vehicle.
Okay.
If he then wanted to buy a new vehicle, they would give him the value added onto his new maintenance plan.
New maintenance plan, yeah. Okay.
So essentially, if you, let's say your plan is 5 years, and then you sell your car in 3 years, the 2 years get given back to the consumer or is transferred to the new vehicle?
Can either be given back, it has to be refunded,
mm-hmm.
Or in the case of a vehicle being written off, they must be refunded, and that will cover all the insurances.
Wow.
So...
That just seems fair.
If you had traded your vehicle in and had a balance of a maintenance plan, they would give you they would refund you and then sell you the new maintenance plan.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Well, which is not happening at this point in time.
Well, I mean, just to be clear, that it doesn't mean you get a full new maintenance plan, right? You just get the balance of
balance,
it.
Balance, yes,
100%. A balance of the maintenance plan. And then let's move on to onto parts. So the commission noted that issues where it was difficult for independent repair shops to obtain or approve original spare parts from manufacturers. Now, I suppose this goes down to what you said right at the beginning. And it sounded to me like technology has driven that exclusion. Is as parts became more sophisticated, so it was more difficult for independent repairers to get their hands on parts and to replace car parts in the environment. You know, would you agree that it's because of technology? Because what happened 10, 15, 20 years ago?
So you must remember this was talking to the aftermarket, the OE parts that were related to the security systems.
Yes.
So up until about 5 years ago, we were allowed to buy those parts.
Okay.
And 5 years ago, they put a blanket refusal to buy any security-related parts.
Couldn't
buy
it. It's not tech-related. It's not because the parts have become sophisticated and smart.
Not at all.
Okay.
They just closed the door.
Because the aftermarket workshops have got a lot of smart people working.
Yes.
Mm. And they have a lot of smart equipment.
Yeah.
And they are quite capable of... installing those parts and encoding them.
Okay, yeah. Okay. All right, so I mean, I suppose that kind of covers the parts situation. And how, in your experience now, it's been a very short time, you know, when did this come about? I think it was end of January?
The first draft was October last year.
Yes, but yeah. Then finally...
A year back?
And then
a year before that,
yeah. When was the final guide?
The final draft was December.
December last year.
The final code, yeah.
Yeah, so the final code was December last year. So it's been a shortish period since the actual final guidelines have been released. What have you seen out in the market? How have OEMs responded, and how have dealerships responded?
Well, the OEMs have relaxed a lot of the stringent rules to the dealerships.
Okay.
And we've seen dealerships now opening their own aftermarket workshops.
Which
previously would never, ever have happened. I mean, I come from the dealer environment many, many years ago. Mm. And, you know, you couldn't even in your own dealership, you weren't allowed to have any other make or vehicle in your workshop.
Yes.
The right repair, the guidelines as it reads now, will allow a dealer, irrespective of what make he's selling,
yes,
to have his own used vehicles being serviced in his workshop.
Okay.
So those things are being relaxed. But it's been like that in Europe for 15 years, 20
yeah.
years now.
Yeah.
So it's not new to the OEMs. I mean, the OEMs have made a big hell and brimstone what's going to happen. But it's been part and parcel of what they've been doing in Europe and in the States.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I should know the answer to this, but you're an independent workshop owner as well, right?
Correct.
I think it's called M Center.
M Center in Centurion.
Yes, yeah. Yes. M Center in Centurion. I think I sent you one or two customers, did I?
You did?
Yeah, I did. I sent you one or two customers. Les knows his stuff when it comes to repairing cars. So, there's no lack of knowledge there. But I suppose the last thing that I wanted to talk about was in the future of electric vehicles. I mean, you own M Center. You've been repairing and servicing internal combustion engine vehicles for a long, long time. How is the future of electric vehicles going to impact independent workshops and dealership workshops and OEM workshops in the future, do you think? And what is being done about it now?
So I wear a number of hats. One of my hats is M Center. A lot of my other hat is I'm a board member of RMI.
Uh-huh.
And also I am a shareholder in a company called Move Workshops.
Okay.
So Move Workshops is a concept. Independent workshops belong to Move. We have what we call a Move Academy, and we've partnered with a service provider in Europe,
okay,
European service provider, and we are actively in consultation with them on knowledge on electric vehicles. So they have training facilities available,
yeah,
where they will be training aftermarket.
Is this Move having training facilities available?
Correct.
That's very interesting. I mean, the Move movement. how did the name come about?
So 4 years ago, we were sitting around a table chatting about things, and we decided to do this concept. But it's been a thing of mine that I've had for many years, from the previous a group of companies in South Africa,
yeah,
from Australia, and I always wanted to start it again because I was very involved in the previous one, and we managed to get a number of shareholders involved, and we started 4 years ago, and it's, we have now 215 workshops in the concept, and we provide all this to our members.
Across. Wow. I was about to say, because I think it's important, if we're going to move into the space of EVs, it's important that there is a network of repairers who know what they're doing, who have essentially trained in how to operate them.
Yeah, we want our Move workshops to be the five-star workshops.
Oh, wow. Mm.
And we try and market them that way.
Okay.
So we, and how we got to the name Move, our one friend, our Finnish friend, Jana, just said, let's move. Let's
just do it.
And,
yeah,
then the name stuck. It was one of those things just around the board.
I think it's quite catchy, actually.
Yeah.
It's quite catchy. So I think that's all we almost have time for, Les. Any kind of final thoughts on the industry and your outlook for 2021?
Yeah, I don't think 2021 is going to be a lot different from what it's been. We sort of see that the right repair, once everybody's got used to it, will start in 6 months to a year from now, where we, you know, people will really start using aftermarket bookshops for their first services.
Brilliant stuff. Wendy, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I just think as a consumer, it's important that you know what your rights are and understand what these guidelines mean for you, because it's going to potentially save you a lot of money. And yeah, it's going to make this project and this movement a lot quicker if more people understand what's going on. So yeah, just
transparency is a good thing.
It is. It's super important. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's been epic. There we go again. Les McMaster, Director of Right to Repair, owner of M-Center, and on the move. And from me, George Minnie, and Wandile Sishi, we will see you next time.